Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly health news magazine. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is produced by WFYI Indianapolis in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. I'm Barbara Lewis. This week on Sound Medicine, overcoming obstacles to learning. We'll learn about the effects of hearing loss.
It's not the cochlear implant that causes the problem. It's the early hearing loss and the delayed access to language.
And why learning to handwrite matters.
What we found was that their brains changed quite substantially as a result of the printing experience.
And in the age of the iPad, why Braille is still useful.
When I got the internal confidence to know it was respectable to be blind, my whole outlook on the possibilities for me changed.
Also, the link between Curious George and tonsillectomies.
We started to recognize that for certain populations and certain procedures, we could set rules to determine who should get them and who shouldn't.
A pushback to a cancer screening recommendation.
I don't think that most of us are ready to be screening every woman over the age of 30.
And we'll tag along behind a walking school bus.
I like that you can get in shape and it gets all your energy out so you can do well during school.
All that and more next on Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly news magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. We're focusing this week on learning, and more precisely, how various childhood conditions can affect brain development and how children interact with the world around them. Let's start with this from child psychologist William Cronenberger.
Our genes really set up the rules for brains to develop, but then beyond that, the way in which a brain develops depends on the experiences that the person has.
Dr. Cronenberger is a professor of clinical psychology at the IU School of Medicine. He focuses on brain development in children.
As a person has a certain type of experience, that affects brain functioning, and the brain learns from that, and there actually is change in brain development. So when there is a significant deviation in someone's exposure to a type of sensation, like vision or hearing, there can be a significant impact on brain development.
Later, we'll explore how learning Braille can affect children who are visually impaired, and a look at the role that learning handwriting plays as well. But first, a look at cochlear implants, those devices that are embedded into the skull to help create sound for people who are deaf. Here's William Cronenberger again.
A cochlear implant is a device that converts sound to an electronic stimulus, which then is sent to the auditory nerve. And what that allows is for someone who has a certain type of hearing loss, a certain type of deafness, it allows them to have access to sound by essentially presenting the electronic stimuli directly to the auditory nerve. The brain then is able to perceive that as sound.
Recently, he told me about a study conducted of a group of children who had received cochlear implants to see how their brains had been affected by hearing loss.
There are at least two very important things that hearing offers to brain development. One is the idea that things occur in sequences. When you listen, you hear things occurring one after the other, and that teaches the brain to process information sequentially. And sequential processing is important for things like planning and for looking at where you are in the present and then making a plan or executing a set of steps to get to the future. So there's an early brain influence of sequential processing. The other area that hearing is very important for, of course, is language development. Very early on, actually even during fetal development, the infant is exposed to sounds of language, and certainly after birth, much language development occurs.
So you recently worked on a team that studied kids who had received a cochlear implant.
One thing that's important to know about cochlear implants is they're not as good as the ear. They're remarkable devices. They provide access to sound. They allow the development of spoken language. But there is some degradation in what they're able to pass on to the auditory nerve.
Okay, so when you say degradation, is it that they just don't hear as clearly?
The details of the sound are not as rich. So you might think of it as even when you listen to the radio, the details of the sound are not as rich as when you're actually in person with someone, or maybe you might think of over the phone. Where you notice it the most with a cochlear implant, it's harder to detect sound within background noise. So, for example, someone talking within background noise would be harder for someone with a cochlear implant to perceive. On the other hand, in quiet, certainly the modern cochlear implants are remarkably good at transmitting sound. And again, what we find is children with hearing loss who would have typically no potential or very limited potential for development of spoken language are typically able to develop spoken language with the input of the cochlear implant.
And in the study, you did find some differences between kids who received a cochlear implant and kids with normal hearing in terms of executive function of the brain. And I guess before we start talking about that, let's talk about the findings. Let's talk about what the executive function is.
Right. So you can think of executive function as mental self-control. It's essentially the ability of the person to control their brain's information processing. So these are things like controlling your attention, staying focused, continuing to work toward a goal without being distracted. These are the executive functions of the brain. So for example, executive functioning is not intelligence, but it would be your ability to direct your intelligence so that you can learn or solve a problem. That's the key.
So the kids with the cochlear implants had a deficit in their executive functioning?
Right. We found a delay in some of the areas of executive functioning in the kids with cochlear implants. The main areas that we found delays in, number one, were controlled attention, the ability to stay focused. Number two, we found weaknesses in what's called verbal working memory, the ability to actively, so not just easy memory, but actively try to remember relatively complex sequences of information, and then also in the ability to plan and to stay with a sequence. Now, the interesting thing about all those is that those were all things that we had suspected might be at risk because of early hearing loss. In other words, it's not the cochlear implant that causes the problem. It's the early hearing loss and the delayed access to language. As a matter of fact, it could be argued, and this is one of the things we're looking at, that the cochlear implant allows potentially a catch-up by providing access to spoken language. But at the time the child receives the cochlear implant, they have had relatively little access to sound, so relatively little hearing, and almost always a delay in spoken language skills. And those seem to interfere with the development of what we call downstream cognitive abilities like planning, attention, and memory.
So the age of children who would get a cochlear implant, I think, is the youngest?
Occasionally under a year.
Okay.
But typically what we see in the United States, typically you're going to see after a year. We study children who are implanted before age 3 years.
Okay. Do they ever catch up? I mean, has that study been done?
Yeah. There's variability. So even in our study where we found an elevated risk of executive function delays, over half of our kids with cochlear implants didn't have executive function delays. So it certainly wasn't a universal finding. The thing was that they were at 2 to 5 times the risk of children with normal hearing to have executive function delays. We have some early data. This is not published yet, but we have some early data that does suggest that there may be some catch-up that takes place. We're trying to figure out who that tends to happen for and what's their secret. Once we know their secret, then we can bring it to the children who are having trouble catching up.
My guest is Dr. William Cronenberger, and we're talking about a new study which looked at children who receive cochlear implants and then some of the deficits they may have in executive function. You compared the children with cochlear implants to kids with normal hearing. Did you do any comparison to deaf children who learn sign language?
Right. So it's a very interesting point, and certainly there is a group of deaf children who learn sign language. One background thing that's interesting to know is that most deaf children are born to parents who can hear and who engage in spoken language. And so very often those parents are interested in their child receiving a cochlear implant for reasons of interacting with them. So there are multiple reasons why children may or may not use sign language versus have a cochlear implant. Children who use sign language, one thing that's important to remember is that they are typically in situations with very different demands. So their school may be different. They may have a person signing for them in the classroom. And this changes the demands on executive functioning. What that means is that it's really comparing apples and oranges because the demands on executive functioning are so different in the different situations. Another sort of practical thing that we have to deal with is that the tests of executive functioning in many cases are at least partly based on spoken language. And so in order to convert them to sign language, we change the tests a little bit. And so that affects what we think we're measuring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how were those tests performed? How do you test for executive function?
Yeah, we have two different types of tests. One type we call neurocognitive tests. And so these are ability tests that a child does in our office. And examples of those, so a neurocognitive test of controlled attention might be on a computer screen. A child sees one of two different stimuli. If they see the first type, they're supposed to press a button. If they see the second type, they're not. The stimuli alternate unpredictably, and the child has to continue to focus and respond appropriately. As their attention wanes, if it does, then they'll respond to the wrong stimulus. That tells us that they're not controlling their attention. Another example might be a child who is presented with a red square and a green square. If I say red, they have to put their finger on the green square. If I say green, they have to put their finger on the red square. This task even drives adults crazy.
Yes.
You absolutely want to point to the square that fits the color, but your executive function is needed, again, to control your processing so that you make a planned, informed decision and give the right answer. So that's the first type of test. We bring the kids in the office. And our first studies, which were done a few years back, looked at that, and that was where we first found differences in the kids with cochlear implants and the normal hearing kids. The second series of studies, including our most recently published ones, we wanted to see whether those things that we observed in the office affected them in real life. And so real life is not pointing to colors. Real life is not pushing bars in response to computer screens. Real life is, you know, paying attention to your mother and remembering the five things you had to do when you went to your bedroom. And so we asked the experts whether the kids were doing that, and of course the experts are the parents. And the parents provided responses about their child's typical behavior. We used a sample of kids with cochlear implants, a sample of kids with normal hearing, and we found the same sorts of differences in the real world as well.
Were the deficits that great that it would affect their abilities in school and social abilities?
They were fairly substantial. So as an example, we found about one out of every 10 normal hearing kids showed a deficit or delay in executive functioning. And that's not far off from what you see in the population. About 5 or 10% of normal hearing children will show those deficits. In kids with cochlear implants, we found 25, 30, 35% showing those deficits in executive functioning. And when you think about all the things that focus and attention and sticking to a plan are important for, you really can see that these things do affect your daily life, whether it's reading a book and sticking with the chapter, whether it's paying attention to what your mother is telling you, whether it's holding back on the frustration that you feel over something that your sibling did. All sorts of situations in life call for self-control. A way that we knew that language was involved is we found that kids with cochlear implants who had better language skills had better executive functioning. And we have data that we're acquiring right now that indicates that if you look at language when they're three, it predicts executive functioning at age four. So this is one of the reasons that we know that the reason for the delay in executive functioning, again, is not the cochlear implant. If anything, the cochlear implant offers the opportunity for them to learn the spoken language. The reason for the delay in executive functioning is likely both the delay in spoken language and that very early delay in auditory experience, in hearing. And remember, babies hear not just right after they're born. They hear in the mother's uterus during pregnancy. So this is a critical component of brain development that we're realizing more and more we need to take into account as we design interventions to help kids with cochlear implants who may be at risk for executive functioning delays.
Well, Dr. William Cronenberger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Cronenberger is a professor of clinical psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the IU School of Medicine. And we'll post more information about his cochlear implant study on our website. You can find it by going to soundmedicine.org.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and your Sound Medicine stat is 13. Would you rather walk around during the day because you want to, or walk around at night because you have to? Those may be the choices for guys of a certain age with a certain problem. That problem is what doctors call nocturia. The rest of us call it having to pee in the middle of the night. So about 30,000 men ages 55 and older came together for a study. The men who were physically active at least an hour a week were 13% less likely to report nocturia than the men who got no physical activity. This is a common problem in men. Nocturia, I mean. The more birthdays you have, the greater the chance you'll get an entire case of it as an unwanted present. But also, lack of exercise, that's a common problem too. Now, 13% might not sound like much protection from peeing in the middle of the night, but then just 1 hour of physical activity a week to lower your risk maybe doesn't sound like that much either. That was The Number 13, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up, why so many fewer children are getting their tonsils out these days. And later, is Braille a thing of the past?
We need Braille to be taught as electives in schools, just like sign language is now being taught, so that people know that there's a need for Braille and that we need teachers of Braille who have high expectations for blind children.
You're listening to Sound Medicine. Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Let's check in with Jill Dittmeyer now for this week's health news headlines.
Thank you, Barb. Two new trials of an Ebola vaccine are underway, and so far volunteers have not reported any adverse reactions. The studies in the U.S. and the U.K. should be completed by the end of the year. By then, scientists hope to have a vaccine available for emergency use. The World Health Organization now reports 2,500 people in West Africa have died from Ebola since the outbreak began in March. The pricey but effective prescription drug for hepatitis C may soon be available for those who have the condition but haven't been able to afford it. Gilead Sciences makes the drug Sovaldi, which roughly costs $1,000 a day. This week, the company signed licensing agreements with several companies to make a generic form of the pill. Dr. Paul Kuo, a professor at the IU School of Medicine, says that the focus now is on identifying people who have hepatitis C early in their illness.
Because if we find them, diagnose them, and link them to care, then we'll have the opportunity to prevent these end-stage complications, which are not only more difficult to treat, but clearly lead to greater cost to the entire healthcare system.
A new study finds that men with one particular type of baldness at age 45 have an increased risk of developing an aggressive form of prostate cancer. That's compared with men of the same age but have a full head of hair. Researchers say men with that specific hair loss pattern in the front and the crown have a higher risk, while there is no link between prostate cancer and other types of baldness. American waistlines are growing, and women's at a faster rate than men's. The CDC released a new study that finds the average American waistline grew from 37.6 inches to 38.8 inches over the past 10 years. A measurement over 35 inches makes a person abdominally obese, and the CDC says 54% of Americans are now in that category. Extra weight around the middle can increase the risk of heart attack and diabetes. Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
A prominent breast cancer researcher recently called for a major expansion in genetic screening for breast and ovarian cancer. Mary Claire King won this year's Lasker Award, known as the American Nobel Prize in Medicine. She discovered the gene known as BRCA1, which can mutate and lead to breast cancer. In accepting the award, she suggested that all women age 30 and older should be screened to see if they have that gene. But another breast cancer expert, Dr. Eric Weiner of Harvard Medical School, told me he's not ready to sign on to such an expansive undertaking.
I think much of this is based on a paper that she and others published that looked at doing genetic screening in Israel, where, in fact, among the Ashkenazi Jewish population, somewhere in the range of 2 to 2.5% of the population has a mutation in what are called the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. And these are genes that if a woman has a mutation in the gene, there is a dramatically increased risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer. The issue in terms of translating those findings to the U.S. is that outside of the Ashkenazi Jewish population, that in the general population in the U.S., the non-Jewish population, the chance of finding a mutation is more in the range of 1 in 500. So this is a much rarer event. And at least at this point in time, I think that most of us would be a little bit concerned about a general recommendation that everyone be screened. I think for women who are of Ashkenazi Jewish background, it's a reasonable thing. I think for women who are obviously have a family history, something that's reasonable. But I don't think that most of us are ready to be screening every woman over the age of 30.
So what do you think is behind this? I mean, why would someone of her stature go ahead and recommend this then?
People are allowed to disagree, and that's okay. And I think that from her standpoint, you know, what she sees is a situation where if a woman knows that she has a mutation, there may be steps that she can take, either prophylactic surgery or extra screening, that would reduce her risk of developing and dying of breast or ovarian cancer. And that of course, is a laudable goal. On the other hand, 1 in 500 is pretty rare. And the other problem that comes up is that when you talk about screening the entire gene, and I'm going to be a little bit more specific about this in a minute, you often find changes in the gene that you're not sure whether they're important or whether they're not important. And that in and of itself can lead to a lot of anxiety and might even lead to some unnecessary procedures as a result of it. You know, and I also think that this may be the difference between someone who is fundamentally a scientist, albeit a scientist with very close connections to the advocacy community and who cares deeply about the health of women, but the difference between a scientist and the difference between a clinician. Because as a clinician, for better or worse, you see how these kinds of recommendations play out on a day-to-day basis in patients and how it affects their lives.
Dr. Eric Weiner is chief of the Division of Women's Cancers at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
You never do know what's around a bend. Big adventure all brand to bring when you're curious.
Years ago, one of the books in the Curious George series told a thinly veiled story of when the monkey had an operation that was followed by ice cream. Recently, Sound Medicine's Dr. Aaron Carroll cited that tale about tonsillectomies in his column for the New York Times online publication Upshot. His point? How evidence-based medicine changed how pediatricians decided which children needed to have their tonsils removed.
There's a real tension these days where people are starting to fight back against the idea that we need to use science and evidence-based medicine to tell us how to practice. And a lot of this comes down to people's rebellion against what we call guidelines or the idea that we can standardize care for certain populations. It's a real tension between, I think, people that think that medicine is an art or people that think medicine is a science. And there are lots of doctors that have very large disagreements as to how this is practiced. But what I was trying to illustrate with the tonsillectomies was that Jack Wenberg, who is now a very famous epidemiologist, but when he started doing this work, this was a very new field, and it was only decades ago. He looked in Vermont, and he found that two neighboring towns had incredibly different rates of tonsillectomy. In one town, something like 70% of kids would have had their tonsils out by a certain age, and the other town, less than 20%. And they truly bordered each other. And he made the point that if he had just moved a couple hundred yards away, the likelihood of his child having a tonsillectomy went way up. And it was not because there was any difference in the children or any difference in disease or any difference in outcomes. It was just that people practiced differently, and there wasn't data to show that this was the case. And when he presented this data to the doctors that did way more tonsillectomies, they started to do less, and they started to actually come up with criteria for how to define if a child should have a tonsillectomy. And when I was a kid, everyone had tonsillectomies. I mean, they were just very, very, very common. These days, they're quite rare. They're making a little bit of a comeback because of apnea, but the idea that every child's going to have their tonsils out and we need even kids' books to explain how this is going to work is much rarer. And that's because we started to recognize that for certain populations and certain procedures, we could set rules to determine who should get them and who shouldn't. It would save us money, and it often led to better quality.
So do you think physicians are using a little more skeptical about guidelines? Because when you were saying, you know, a tonsillectomy, sure, I remember that growing up, but I also remember as an adult, every child I knew had ear tubes.
Yep. And I think there's been a lot of pushback against that as well. And I think that part of it is that we're starting to try to use, and we say starting even though this has been going on for decades, but starting to use evidence and research methods and quality assurance to see what actually happens to people. And we've seen that often huge variations in care exist across the country, and we're not seeing huge outcome improvements by doing more. And so there have been guidelines and attempts to try to standardize care, which has shown that we can reduce spending and we can also improve quality. Part of the problem is that a lot of doctors don't even know the guidelines exist. In the piece, I cite a study that talks about the percent of pediatricians that know that various guidelines exist, and it's somewhat shocking to see how few physicians know they exist, let alone say they're going to follow them. And even when they know they exist, the majority refuse to follow them because they say they're too cookbook, or their patients don't apply, or somehow they don't work, or that they know better. And it's a problem, and it's hard to get us to recognize that these do improve care. Part of the problem is I think everybody assumes it's an all or nothing thing. And it's important to recognize that guidelines aren't about everybody, but guidelines should set forward specific instances where for certain patients with certain criteria, we know what's best. We figured that out. And for those patients, we should do this. The art of medicine comes in recognizing which patients don't fit into the guideline, which patients are different because they have a different history or because some other factor which the guideline doesn't take into account, makes it so that it doesn't apply to this patient. Physicians are still necessary, but they could still learn quite a bit from evidence-based medicine.
Dr. Aaron Carroll, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Aaron Carroll is a professor of pediatrics at the IU School of Medicine, a blogger and a columnist for the New York Times, and a regular guest here on Sound Medicine. And now, Sandy Robe with her series, Help Yourself. Help yourself.
Looking for a healthy way to get your kids to school? Maybe you could help organize a walking school bus. Many children across the nation are joining walking and biking routes as part of a movement to become more physically active and to fend off childhood obesity.
Hi, Heslins.
Hi, Heslins.
Morning. Good job.
I caught up with the walking school bus headed to St. Thomas Aquinas early one morning in Indianapolis. It operates like a bus route without the bus and has planned pickup points along the way. I met 10-year-old Freddie Garver at one stop.
I like that you can get in shape and it gets all your energy out so you can do well during school.
Freddie walks this route with a group of nearly 20 kids and parent volunteers on a regular basis. It's one of four routes available to kindergartners through eighth graders who make the trek to school.
How's it going, guys?
Good.
Okay, it's our turn. Let's go, guys. Stick together. Do not go in the street, please.
That's Jenny Forsey, one of the walking school bus drivers. It's her job to be in front and get the group across the street safely. The program is a part of a larger federal initiative called Safe Routes to School. Forsey has seen the positive impact it's had on the kids during the last 4 years.
I think just starting your day with some fresh air is so good for their brains. And just the camaraderie, they look so forward to seeing their friends along the way. And it's so fun to enter school together as a group and just get your energy up and get a little bit of exercise. It just feels so good.
This particular route takes about 25 minutes to walk. Those miles add up. Just ask Freddie.
We live 0.9 miles away, and we've walked every day except one, so that would be about... I have no idea.
Luckily, the kids can leave math for the classroom and let a computer program figure out their mileage.
Have the best day ever. Have a great day, guys.
Hey, Freddie.
The students carry scan tags, similar to what is used at a grocery store. They scan the barcode at a laptop computer before entering the building. Jennifer Pierce, a mother of three, is the Safe Routes coordinator for the school.
It's a program that a dad out of California developed. It's a real small program, but it works great. It tallies up how many miles they walked that particular day and then over the school year. It tells them how many calories they burned.
As the school day begins, so does the excitement of offering the program to kids in more neighborhoods and schools.
Good morning, good morning. Good morning, second grade.
Principal Kara Swinefurth says program grants have helped make many infrastructure improvements, like repairing neighborhood sidewalks.
We were able to do a lot with curb bump outs, flashing signs that make drivers aware that it's a pedestrian area, that it's a school zone, and so that's helped everyone.
Anyone can start a walking school bus. It can begin with two families and grow to a larger group activity. It just takes a schedule, a route to school, adult supervision, and a willingness to get some exercise. I'm Sandy Robe, encouraging you to
help yourself.
And for the parents who walk along with that kid-powered school bus, whether they have a snack afterwards or not, depends on whether they think it was exercise or just plain fun. Here's Jill Dittmeyer with this week's Sound Medicine Checkup.
Really, very few people in the world love to exercise. We exercise as a means to an end.
And most of the time, that end includes a reward, says Dr. Brian Wansick with the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab.
You know, we might reward ourselves by doing something indulgent, like maybe overeating.
Which defeats the purpose if you're exercising to lose weight.
Simply by readjusting the way we view things, it can have a dramatic impact on what happens after the activity.
Wansick proved his theory by taking two different groups of people for a walk.
The first group left, and they were told that it was a scenic walk around a little lake.
They wore headphones and listened to music.
The second group walked the same distance, same pace, but instead they were told that it was an exercise walk. Their guide would every quarter mile would say, okay, we're quarterly done. Okay, now we're almost halfway done. We're almost whatever.
Then they had lunch.
When they served lunch, what we found is that people who thought they were in an exercise walk, even though they walked the same distance, the same pace, ended up eating about 35% more dessert. They didn't eat more of an entree. Okay, we gave them like salad, pasta, and nice chocolate pudding. They didn't eat more of a pasta. They actually ate a little bit less salad. And they ate about 35% more dessert. The idea was they were rewarding themselves for having done this darn exercise thing that they dislike to do so much.
Wansick says the key is to make the activity the reward.
The perfect thing to do is to look at any sort of physical activity we're doing as something we get to do. Okay, hey, I get to go on a run today and get away from the office and get away from the family. I get to lift the weights today and bust some stress so that I'm really calm and cool and collected for the rest of the day.
Especially when eating less is our goal.
Then there's less of a chance they're going to blow their diet afterwards. In the same way the people who were doing the headphone test didn't overeat compared to the group that believe they're doing exercise.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Do you want to listen to Sound Medicine anytime? Sign up for our free weekly podcast. Click the box at our website, soundmedicine.org. You can also find us at iTunes, at Stitcher Radio, and at Swell AM.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. We continue now looking at children's brain development and how it affects their learning. My next guest is Dr. Karen Harmon James. She's been looking at what happens inside a child's brain while he or she is learning to write by hand, as opposed to typing on a keyboard. Dr. James, welcome to Sound Medicine.
Thank you.
Now, you have a very special interest in figuring out what goes on in people's brains while they're using their hands. So how did you become interested in handwriting in particular?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I've always been interested in motor behavior in general with people, and I kind of stumbled across this when I was doing some research on reading acquisition. And we were imaging some children that were learning to read and realized that they were having motor activation in their brains. And so we were curious as to what that was all about. And so that's kind of how I got into it.
Okay, so these were five-year-olds. Five-year-olds yes, in an MRI machine sounds complex enough.
Yeah, sometimes it is.
So you were really kind of looking at what happens. Tell me a little bit about that study that
sure.
you did with them.
Well, the first couple of studies we did with them was basically followed a similar procedure. We imaged the children in an MRI machine, measuring their functional brain activation while they do things in real time. And in this particular case, what they were doing was looking at letters and numbers and simple shapes. And then what we do usually is we train them after that initial scanning session. In this case, we train them to print letters. In other experiments, we've also had them type letters. We've had them trace letters. And we compare this with tracing and typing and writing shapes as well, like simple shapes like circles and triangles and things. And then what we do after that training period, we bring them back into the MRI scanner, and we look at how their brain has changed as a result of that experience. What we found was that with these four to six year olds that were pre-literate, so they weren't readers, they could look at letters and they could recognize some of their alphabet, but not all. And what we found was that their brains changed quite substantially as a result of the printing experience and not so much as a result of typing or tracing. In particular, what we found was that before any of this training, the children's brains didn't respond differently to letters and simple shapes. So it's almost like the brain treats those symbols the same early on before you read. And then after the printing practice, what we found is that the children who learned to print the letters, then their brains responded as if they could read. They responded as if very much like adults that read.
So what is it about writing that seems to recruit parts of our brain in a way that typing on a keyboard just doesn't?
We're still trying to figure that out. That's an open question. We're really active right now in my lab trying to figure out what it is about writing. It's been now documented that that happens, but, you know, the next step is figuring out why. So I think people that are in this field are in agreement that this is a fine motor skill, and fine motor skills are very important. And creating these shapes oneself seems to be part of the importance, not just pressing a key and there it is. So piece by piece, feature by feature, creating these symbols seems to be something that's important for the brain activation to result the way it does.
So reading and writing have always gone hand in hand in school, but it seems like many states now don't require public schools to teach cursive. So the
right.
kids are more computer-based, you know, these days. Could this have any effect on their ability to read or think critically? Does not writing cursive take something away from their ability to learn?
You know, I don't specifically study cursive writing as in-depth as some other folks do, but from what I've seen, the taking cursive away probably doesn't have much of an effect in terms of brain activation. The problem would be if we took away the early printing experience and replaced that with keyboarding. But, you know, I think at this point, schools are still teaching printing early on, and preschools are still teaching printing, so to me that's a good thing. But it's harder to say if something like printing per se is actually having an effect on subsequent cognitive development, but it's pointing in that direction, that early printing is really important for things like working memory, for reading, as I said. And so it does seem to have a fairly wide-reaching effects on and many sort of different types of cognitive development, but there's still lots of research to be done.
Well, Dr. Karen Harmon-James, thank you so much for talking with me on Sound Medicine.
Okay, thank you so much.
So this is embarrassing. I wrote your Harmon down, and my handwriting was so bad I couldn't. I almost had to stop you and say, oh, my God, did I get it right?
Oh, handwriting is fun. We know it must be done. Learning better strokes for folks enhances everyone.
Dr. Karen Harmon-James is an associate professor in psychology at IU Bloomington. We'll post the findings of the study she conducted. It's on our website at soundmedicine.org. And finally this week, among children who are blind, only 1 in 10 learns Braille anymore. That's according to the National Federation of the Blind. And there is concern that the other 9 are missing out on learning important skills when they don't learn Braille. To learn more, we turn to the Federation's executive director, Mark Riccobono. He told me that the low number goes back to low expectations.
Braille is misunderstood. It's seen as not normal because, of course, print is perceived as being the normal thing. And so because there are low expectations, there's an assumption that Braille is slower than print and that a child who is blind, if they have any degree of vision, the first thing that we should do is maximize their ability to read print, even if that print needs to be 72-point font or something, and even if the reading is very slow. There's not a look at Braille as being equivalent to print and that blind people can be equally effective with Braille as they can with print. So it's really kind of a misguided bias and low expectations about the capacity of blind people dealing with Braille.
So are there fewer teachers of Braille? I was just wondering if a lot of the children who are blind are attending school where Braille wouldn't even be offered.
Yeah, well, the majority of blind children are receiving educational services in their local public school, and oftentimes there is a shortage of qualified teachers who know Braille. Sometimes that is one of the things that prevents school districts from providing appropriate Braille instruction. But the other thing that contributes to that is Braille needs to be more widely promoted and understood. We need Braille to be taught as electives in schools, just like sign language is now being taught, so that people know that there's a need for Braille and that we need teachers of Braille who have high expectations for blind children.
You know, Mark, it struck me when I was preparing for this interview that kids are going to tablets. You know, we're going away from like a printed page. So where would Braille have a part in learning for the children of the future who are blind?
Well, this is really where the digital revolution has tremendous opportunities for blind people. First of all, the National Federation of the Blind has been a leader in making sure that digital content, whether it be on the internet or through mobile apps or digital books, that all of those materials are accessible to a blind person. That is to say, digital content is just ones and zeros. And if it's built correctly, it will read correctly using speech output, a voice that would read the text to you. But more importantly, the devices that we have today, not just PCs, but mobile devices that are designed correctly, can connect to what we call refreshable Braille displays. So these are basically, think of a technology, a row of Braille cells that is technology driven mechanically that drives pins up and down to represent the Braille code. And it's refreshable because I can have one line and I hit a key to scroll to the right, for example, and those pins refresh to show me the next part of that line. And that technology has actually been around for a long time, and I have one sitting right here on my desk. It's actually connected to my iPhone, so I could send a text here while I'm doing this interview. Of course, I wouldn't do that. Read email, or for that matter, read electronic books in any of the accessible book systems that are available on the market. So actually, today's children, using both the mainstream technology, like the iPhone or the iPad, along with refreshable Braille displays, have greater access to information in Braille than ever before, because you can now carry around hundreds of books and read them in Braille, whereas just the sheer size of Braille, it was difficult to carry around one large book because it would be in Braille many volumes, whereas a print book is typically just the one volume. So we're currently working on new approaches to the refreshable Braille technology that would make it much, much cheaper and much more available. This device that I have on my desk is a $1,600 device. We need this device to be a $300 or $250 device.
I'm speaking with Mark Riccobono. He's executive director of the National Federation of the Blind. We're talking about the current role of Braille. He mentioned something called a refreshable Braille display. If you're not sure what that looks like, we've posted a picture for you on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org.
Reading of Braille is a very active process, just like reading print is. So the comparison really and oftentimes is to audio, because people think, well, if you're blind, you can just get everything through audio. But audio is a passive process, and it's not as active as reading. So then we go to the 72-point font. A lot of times people say, well, at least she can read some print. But the test is often, what print can she read right here at this moment? We know that people don't read in little two-second chunks, right? We need to be able to read for a sustained time. And the problem has been children are evaluated on what font size they can see at a moment under a particular lighting condition. And it's hardly ever been tested over time. So the kids, like myself when I was young, I could read very large print for a short period of time, but after 10 minutes, 15 minutes, my eyes would become more blurry. I would begin to develop a headache. So I could only read print for very short chunks of time. By the time you get to high school, right, you need to be reading for hours on end sometimes. So if what you have is you have to take a break every 10 minutes, you're not going to be effectively competing with your sighted peers, whereas Braille, you don't have that barrier. So
you're limiting your education in a way. I mean, if you're being asked to read at a, you know, college material or really, you know, have that full experience of reading the printed word, that's what you're talking about with where Braille really increases your chance of a better job, more education, a better life.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that because of the percentage of blind people who are employed, and 70% of blind people are still unemployed or underemployed. Better than 80% of the blind people who are employed have some training in Braille and use of Braille. So there's a high correlation between Braille and employment. There's been studies that show a high correlation between Braille usage and income level. And the most important thing really is that people who use Braille identify themselves as blind people. They're not trying to fake it like I did for many years. I tried to pretend I could see things because what I learned was it was normal to be sighted and I wanted to be viewed as sighted, even though I couldn't see lots of stuff. I was faking it. When I got the internal confidence from the National Federation of the Blind to know it was respectable to be blind and that that was just another characteristic, my whole outlook on the possibilities for me changed. And then when I got Braille, I had another tool in my toolbox that really opened up a whole new avenue of literacy. I can give a speech. I can read notes to you while I'm talking on the phone without having a computer talking in the background. I mean, there's 100 things. These are all tied together. And Braille readers, in many ways, are leaders.
How hard is Braille to learn? I mean, when did you learn it? And can you tell us about your own experience?
Well, Braille is not another language. Braille is a code. So it's English. It's the alphabet. It's just a different way of representing the alphabet, and of course in a different form. It's tactile rather than visual. So I didn't learn Braille till about the summer that I turned 21. Learning the code wasn't the hard part. So learning dot one is A, the character for W is this combination of dots. That part is relatively easy, and I learned the entire Braille code over the summer, and that's slightly more complex than just the 26 letters of the alphabet. The problem is, and where it requires work for people like me who learned Braille later, is building up the reading speed and fluency. Obviously, if you're a child dealing with Braille from the beginning, you're learning to read as your reading is getting more complex. So by the time you get to high school, to college, you have speed and fluency that you can whip through stuff. Well, if you're a blind adult learning Braille, you have to read and use the code in order to build up the speed. So now that I've been using Braille for 15 years or so, I notice the difference. There are words that would have stopped me in Braille just because I didn't have the fluency that I fly over now. And good Braille readers read hundreds of words a minute. I know a Braille reader that reads 500 words a minute. She took a standard speed reading course with sighted individuals. She took it in Braille. So it's only hard to the extent that we tell people it's hard, it's difficult to do, and we don't give them the right teaching methods and training and time to develop the fluency. We really have access to all of the suite of devices and services that are out there as long as the developers of those applications follow the accessibility guidelines. And that's one of the challenges we're particularly confronted with in the universities right now. In fact, we have a bill in the Congress to try to create standards for digital content in higher education, because a lot of times technologies being used in higher education aren't built to be accessible to blind students, and that means they're shut out of the classroom. They can't participate in the online chat. They can't get the professor's notes off the wiki that's been provided. They can't interact with class discussions in online formats. So one of the frustrations we have with the digital technology is that it presents lots of great opportunities and promise, but it also, in some ways, is making it more difficult for blind people to get an education. And so we feel like we're in a race, and we're trying to win the race by promoting that technology should be built with people with disabilities in mind from the beginning.
Mark Riccobono is Executive Director of the National Federation of the Blind. And that's it for this week's program. If there's a topic that you want to learn more about, send us a suggestion at our Facebook page or click the contact button on our website at soundmedicine.org. Sound Medicine Senior Producer is Nora Hyatt. Eric Metcalf prepares our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits the program, and he chooses our music. Jen Burnham manages our website as well as all things social media. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music. Our executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated. All rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.